Okay, good morning, everyone. I'm going to call the committee, the remote committee of Human Services, Finance, and Policy to order. Today, members, we're hearing three bills. They should go fairly quickly, so you may get extra time today before your next meeting, maybe to eat lunch or take a walk outside. Mm-hmm. And then tomorrow, we're hearing three bills, and Thursday, we have two bills on the agenda. So we're going to start with taking the roll. Ms. Hansen, please take the roll.
Yes. Good morning, everyone. Chair Schultz.
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner.
Present.
Lead Albright.
Good morning. Present.
Good morning. Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Burkle.
Present.
Representative Fisher.
Fisher, present.
Good morning. Good Representative morning. Frederick.
Present.
Representative Hansen. Representative Keel.
Present.
Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Good morning. Representative Knorr.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Present.
Thank you. Representative Pearson.
Pearson, present.
Representative Pinto. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Sandel. And we have Representative Schumacher excused today.
I believe Representative Pinto is in another committee. He'll join us later.
Okay.
To present his bill, so he's excused from the first vote. Okay, members, we have a quorum. So let's see, Representative Bonner, would you like to move the minutes from February 18th?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to move the minutes from February 18th.
Okay, Representative Bonner removes the minutes from February 18th. Any discussion or corrections to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the minutes from February 18th, 2021 are approved. Okay, members, the first item on our agenda, the first bill for consideration is House File 713. So I move that Representative Stevenson's bill, House File 713, be recommended to be placed on the general register. So we have the bill before us. Representative Stevenson, welcome to the committee. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your bill? And I see that you have one testifier.
That's right, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for hearing the bill and for your time today. I think this might set a personal record for me as the briefest bill introduction that I will ever do, because this is a very straightforward bill that just makes a brief change to make it easier to complete MFIP forms. Essentially, it will allow the forms to be, for errors on the forms to be corrected over the phone or in writing. It was brought to me by my county. Very happy to sponsor this common sense legislation. I do have a testifier from Anoka County with me, Brad Teal, Director of Economic Assistance Department.
Okay, welcome, Mr. Teal. Please introduce yourself and your title for the record, and then proceed with your testimony.
excuse me. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brad Teal, and I am the director of the Economic Assistance Department in Anoka County. My department includes all public assistance programs and child support. I want to thank you for your time this morning and the ability to appear remotely. This legislation comes out of discussions regarding creating greater efficiencies in our programs from lessons we've learned through COVID and having our buildings closed and to the public and most staff working remotely. This proposal is to delete the return incomplete form language and replace it with contact the caregiver by phone or in writing to acquire the necessary information to complete the form. This would create efficiencies for both the client and staff and eliminate the need to mail the form to the client and for the client to mail the form back before it can be processed. The current statute creates unnecessary delays in benefits being issued. And sometimes on the form, what's missing, maybe they didn't check a box or something minor. This proposal also is supported by the membership of the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, also known as MACSA. I was a former lead of a committee there. We ran it through our committee process and membership, and they approved it as well. So I would appreciate your support as well as the committee, and I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Teal. Representative Keel?
Generally, my question got answered, but I just was curious as to how the counties were in generally, our counties are different sizes. How does that work for them? Is that binding? Should somebody give you the wrong information by phone or how does that get handled now?
Mr. Teal?
Madam Chair, Representative, what occurs now is we have to mail the incomplete form back to the participant and explain to them what part of the form is incomplete, have them complete the form and return it back to us. The language still includes in the bill, it still includes the ability to mail it if the phone call doesn't work. So that's how we fit all counties' needs. So some counties maybe still want to mail it back, or maybe that's how we contact them. Others, the phone would work. So it gives us another option there. And information that's provided also still needs to be verified. So we're not changing anything in the process, just giving us one more tool in our toolbox to get benefits issued timely in this case. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to confirm, are you having quite a bit of success getting a hold of people when you do need that confirmation of information or the fill-in where they missed it?
Mr. Teal?
Madam Chair, Representative, yeah, when we, in our current process, we do get the needed information back. If they don't provide that information, then their benefits cannot be issued. So it is pretty, it works. It's just a really laborsome, time-consuming process. So we're just trying to make it more efficient. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Keel?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Bonner?
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, a quick comment and a question. First, I just want to thank you, the author of the bill, for bringing this forward. I know in the Early Childhood Committee, we had a vast number of discussions about how we make sure that we have people-centered government that works for real families and how we streamline those processes to make it easier for folks in the community. So I really appreciate that. But my question is this. In the bill, it suggests that we are allowing for written communication on lines 1.11. It says caregiver by phone or in writing. And I'm just curious, when we say in writing, if that includes electronic communications?
Mr. Teal?
Madam Chair, Representative, it would allow for that particular language. Let me just take a quick look at it. I don't know if we've contemplated the electronic part. What we're thinking is the form, we could return the form to the client, or we could get the information by phone. As electronic communication gets better, they will send it, but we're really trying to complete, we still need to have a requirement, as I understand it, to complete the form. So it's either sending the form back to them, or we'll complete the form by that phone conversation. I think the language could be broad enough, also as I'm reading it in your context of your question, to probably allow us a greater communication but that's kind of how we contemplated the language at the moment.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment on that and to the author. You know, we see that technology takes such a huge part in our lives these days, and it's become more and more a part of our daily lives with devices on our phones, our iPads, a telephone. I don't know anyone who barely doesn't have a phone. So candidly, if the language does not include this, and maybe our researcher could confirm that, I would love to have the author potentially entertain the option to add that to the language, just to give additional flexibility and really make it work for ordinary citizens.
Yes, I would like if the House Research is here, or DHS, if they could comment on whether in writing also includes an email communication. Ms. Schlick?
Representative Schultz and committee members and Representative Bond, we would interpret this to mean that, for instance, in writing could be a text over the phone, or in writing could be an email. This form is not currently an electronic form. Taking away the language that it has to be sent back gets rid of the assumption that that's a paper form that has to be passed through the mail or hand to hand.
Thank you for that clarification, Ms. Schlick. Representative Bonner?
Perfect. Thank you so much for the clarification, Ms. Schlick and Madam Chair. I really appreciate that clarification, and that definitely helps. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Representative Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say thank you to Representative Stevenson for bringing this bill forward. It's much needed. I can understand when the household report form comes incomplete and the work that you have to do that work almost three times. I just have a quick clarification. Some of my questions have already been asked. What is the cost related to, you know, mailing those back at the same time when they don't mail the information back on the 16th? We spend money by generating automatic notices. How will this really help in reducing some of the costs associated with the reporting and paperwork that we are sending to the clients?
Mr. Teal?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have an actual cost calculation, but as you noted, this would be a cost savings too in postage and printing to send the follow-up notices back, mail the notice to the client, a cost on our part as counties and tribes, and then the cost to the client, or cost again to us if we send them a self-addressed stamped envelope. So this can be a cost savings as well. It's more, the purpose of it is more, in addition to that being cost savings, efficiencies, as well as a non-delaying or unnecessary delay of benefits to clients, which is our primary purpose. Thank you.
Representative Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the follow-up to that process of the savings to the counties and the cost that they're doing, Ms. Schlick, for the state in terms of reducing the cost of sending the first notification for the house to the household on the 16th, and also if we don't get the required paperwork, the closure of the case on the 26th, is that still a process that we're doing at the state level?
Ms. Schlick?
Representative Schultz, Representative Noor. Yes, I can't promise the dates are exactly right, but I trust that you know those dates well. So that is a process that has to be followed. As Mr. Thiel explained, that's a cost borne by counties, mailing and postage, so it doesn't show up as a state fiscal note. And if people are late, their benefits are ended, but then when they get the information in, they're started up again. So it's a delay in getting those benefits out.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick. Representative Noor.
Oh, thank you so much, Madam Chair. I think there's something that we want to look into, the number of notices that go to the clients when it comes to programs, minor changes, things that we can actually reduce the cost of overhead when we use we used to call it the IOC, which is the, you know, space that we have for sending the automatic mail. So we need to look into that as a piece of trying to do a long term. But at this point, I think this is a great bill, and I support what we're doing in terms of reducing the need to mailing and ensuring that we can do the casework and we don't have to wait for the 16th or the 26th. I'm just picking those dates from a long time ago. To make sure that we process timely those cases and we can avoid closure of the program. So thank you so much, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Stevenson, for bringing this bill.
Thanks, Representative Noor. It's impressive that you remember those dates. Let's see, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Stevenson, for bringing this bill. I just had a quick follow-up, similar to a question Representative Keel had, and it's just for my own information, because I don't really know how these things are verified. So if someone could just explain to me, when they fill out the paper form, the testifier said that that information has to be verified. If it's filled out over the phone, is it the same verification process? Because my concern is that if there's a mistake made between either the person giving the information or the person taking it down, and then it's not really well documented who made the mistake, how will that impact benefits? So I'm all about efficiency. I honestly wish that these forms were online and we didn't have to drag people down and fill them out on paper. Like I'm with Representative Botter. I hope we eventually get to doing this all electronically, but since we're not there yet, I am worried about the sort of chain of custody of this information and who bears the responsibility if there's a mistake made. Does the client, does the person who took the information over the phone? I just want to understand that better and how it's verified in either process. Thank you.
Ms. Schlick, are you able to address that question?
Representative Schultz and Representative Robbins, I can start. Brad Field, being closer to operations, may and originating the bill may do a better job. But we have instructed counties and the people we serve during COVID, where we're doing more work over the phone, that all the fraud rules and policies still apply, whether we get the information verbally or we get it in writing. The verifications are about they're about income, or they're about an address status, or about relationship between members of the household, a birth certificate. So many of those verifications come in at application. When there's a change, then we need the verification again. Things like income, paychecks are now increasingly available as an electronic verification. It isn't just a paper pay stub that has to be mailed in. It can often be electronically verified. But again, I'm thinking Mr. Thiel may have other examples that his staff deal with most commonly.
Mr. Thiel, do you have anything to add to that?
Madam Chair, and Representative, Deborah Schlick did a great job of explaining that the verifications would still be required, whatever the current rules on those are. And as far as the documentation, we would document that on our system. So we'd make a case note about this conversation occurred on this date. This is the information that was provided. And then if there was, some controversy to that later or information needed to be rechecked, that would be our kind of record keeping about it, which is now we're getting, could get paperwork in or get something in electronically. That would be a verification in the file. But when we're doing this on phone, especially now with some waivers in place as well, we're just documenting this occurred on this day. This is how it happened. But everything else that would be in, everything else about our rules around it, as Ms. Schlick talked about, those are still in place. We're just giving this bill gives us some efficiencies and gives us another option to get the to correct the form so we can continue processing the application.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Robbins. Okay. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Stevens, I note that your bill requires for this reporting mechanism to happen monthly, but yet governor has proposed making these requiring these forms to be submitted less regularly. Why the difference?
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Albright, this bill makes a minor change. It doesn't actually change existing law to the time frame. I can't speak to the governor's proposal as I haven't been involved with it and it isn't reflected in this bill. This bill doesn't deal with the timing. It doesn't change the timing that's already existing under current law. It just changes the manner in which the information can be conveyed.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also, I guess a question for the testifier. How often do the changes in the family information change? Are there material changes, broadly speaking, month to month, or is it just minor verifications that you're looking for?
Mr. Thiel?
Madam Chair, Representative, that'll vary greatly depending on the type of case that we're talking about. Some households will have changes regularly, maybe monthly. Others, their situation, income, and household makeup is, you know, consistent throughout time. So it's going to really be, I don't have any hard numbers here, but every one of our cases, every one of our households is different. So, and they're required to report changes, you know, as they occur to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thiel. So are these monthly reports or only reporting when things change, Mr. Thiel?
I was on mute. I think this covers both, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, one of the things that I observe about this, and I'm not trying to decry the initiative, but it certainly seems like we're moving towards a protocol where the onus is on the county and or the agency in terms of making sure that the forms are filled out correctly and completely, as opposed to the applicant. Now, I'm not denigrating the need for the program, but I see a subtle shift in terms of the applicant looking to update their information, as opposed to, you know, kind of helicopter parenting from the state's perspective on every one of these. Now, I understand about efficiencies. I can certainly appreciate if there's a missing crossed T or dotted I, but when there's an applicant who's looking to verify, you know, have these benefits, which are expensive to administer, beneficial nonetheless, where is in the integrity of the system? We're sliding towards the applicant really basically, you know, mailing in an incomplete form, and to Representative Robbins' concerns, where's the integrity in the system to verify that the information is true and correct? Given the fact that MFIP is basically just a cash distribution system with no provisos on it in terms of what its responsibilities are, it is the ultimate welfare program to begin with. We've got a bill coming up with Representative Pinto that's much similar in terms of, why wouldn't you just think about this as a universal income demonstration program and call it for what it is? If anyone wants to respond, certainly welcome it, but more of a statement than a question.
Well, thank you, Representative Albright. You know, we as a state put the burden on the counties to do all of this reporting to reduce potential fraud and abuse. So we're requiring significant reporting for a very small sum of money for cash assistance. And we've learned how important this is to get people out of poverty and welfare, and to get them to make sure they have the opportunities to thrive in our state. Representative Bonner?
I wonder if it's possible for someone to just clarify too, some of the common things that might be missing, and why that might be, because I think that when we have this conversation, it feels like some of the things, to my understanding, that have been missing have been relatively minor things, or maybe one line got missed where this could easily be remedied rather than. So it's not that the applicant wasn't giving their best faith effort to fill out the form or to supply the information. I'm just curious if someone could speak to that and give a little bit more information.
Mr. Thiel?
Madam Chair, Representative, I use in my example, I don't unfortunately have any examples in front of me. Sometimes it is like a box that needs to be checked or some other minor information is typically what we see. So I agree with your comment that it's not somebody necessarily trying to, you know, game the system. It's just they're filling out this form and, you know, they move from one line to the next or didn't realize that they missed a line. So that's what was presented to me, is sometimes it is like a box that needs to have a check mark in it to make the form complete. And we would always, to the previous comment too, we always verify if there's something that in our process, we're verifying this information. So that's why we think this is, you know, for us ability to pick up the phone instead of doing a two or three step, four step process, is clearly an efficiency that benefits both the client and our staff.
Mr. Thiel, what percentage of forms come back that are incomplete? Do you know, on average?
Madam Chair, I do not have a percentage in front of me. Sorry.
Okay, Representative Bonner.
I just want to say thank you for that clarification. I really appreciate that. And you know, certainly, you know, wherever we can save time, money, and effort and streamline government process and really serve people better, I think just makes good common sense. So I appreciate that clarification. Thank you.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to thank the author for bringing the bill forward. And one of the things I want to make sure that people understand is this appears to me to be meeting the people that where they're at, meeting our clients where they're at. Now, having worked with clients who are in this type of situation when they're trying to fill out applications, sometimes it's mistake. Number one, mistakes get made. You're also dealing with people who are in very vulnerable situations. And so sometimes they may send out application information and they may be at one address and they change addresses another time because they don't have stable housing. And so what we're trying to do is meet the people and help those who are most vulnerable. Vulnerable people aren't always going to be thinking straight, being able to process everything because they're under great stress. And it's important that we do what we can to help make the job easier for the county and to be able to help our clients out there who are in true need to be able to be successful down the road. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments, Representative Fisher. Appreciate that. So I'm going to, I don't see any more questions, so I'll renew my motion to place House File 713 on the General Register. And this requires a roll call vote. So Ms. Hansen, can you prepare a roll call vote? Chair votes aye.
Schultz, aye. Vice Chair Bonner?
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Lead Albright?
No.
No. Albright votes no. Thank you. Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Burkle.
No.
Burkle, no. Representative Fisher.
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hansen.
Hansen, aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Keel.
Keel, no.
Keel, no. Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Mueller, aye. Representative Moore.
Yes.
Moore, yes. Representative Novotny.
Novotny, no.
Novotny, no. Representative Pearson.
Pearson, nay.
Pearson, no. Representative Pinto is excused. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, no.
Rasmussen, no. Representative Robbins?
No.
Robbins, no. Representative Sandell?
Aye.
Sandell, aye. And Representative Schumacher is also excused. So we have 10 ayes, 7 nays, and 2 excused, Chair Schultz.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. The motion passes, and House Bill 713 is on its way to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Stevenson and Mr. Thiel. Okay, the next item for consideration is House File 822. So I'll move that Representative Kegel's bill, House File 822, be laid over for possible inclusion in the Human Services Finance Bill. Now that we have the bill before us, Representative Kegel, welcome to the committee. Please tell us about your bill, and it looks like Mr. Thiel is going to be your testifier, and there are no amendments.
Correct. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House File 822 was brought to me by my county, Anoka County, and the bill came out of a working group that DHS convened to look into the issue of business accounts being used to pay for household expenses and then people applying for benefits. So this bill closely tracks the work group's recommendations. And under this bill, when someone is using business accounts to pay for personal expenses, the agency would take that into account when the person is seeking benefits. And so that's just a brief explanation. And with that, I will turn it over to my testifier.
Mr. Thiel, welcome back. Please introduce yourself for the record again and state your title.
Great. Good morning. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Brad Thiel. I'm the Director of the Economic Assistance Department in Anoka County. My department includes all public assistance programs and child support. I want to thank you for your time this morning and the ability to appear remotely. House File 822, this is the purpose of this bill is, as indicated, some self-employed people pay most or all of their personal expenses using business or commingled accounts, which allows them to plead poverty when they are applying for or renewing eligibility for public assistance programs. And a clear definition of the use of this money in this way will count income into the eligibility. And the current statute currently does not clearly define what income is in these situations. This language, or the language we have now, is a combination of multiple years of bringing this item forward through our organizations. And in 2019, the legislature required a working group of stakeholders to be put together by DHS to talk about the issues and to propose language. As I stated, the current bill language is a result of a work group made up of multiple DHS departments, Department of Revenue, and several counties, both metro and outstate, both small and large counties. The work group was facilitated by DHS. I just want to thank Deborah Schlick and Ryan Johnson of DHS for a great job in putting together and facilitating this work group over multiple months and multiple meetings. And the requirements for the creation of the work group, as I stated, was requested by the legislature. The work group identified the following criteria the new legislative language should meet. Make it possible to catch people trying to hide self-employment income. Don't turn eligibility workers into tax accountants. Do not create unnecessary barriers to eligibility for people who are truly eligible. Make sure workers can understand, explain, and get policy right so that people we serve can understand what is expected of them. Have policies consistent or uniform across programs as possible. Clarify the roles of eligibility worker, fraud investigators, and Minnesota Department of Revenue. The proposed language that you see in front of you today in the bill accomplishes this criteria just described. And what we want to make sure that people who need assistance get assistance, and people who do not need assistance do not receive assistance. All clients, people who are not self-employed and people who are self-employed, should have their income counted in the same manner. This language and bill is also supported by MACSA, the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators. We brought it through their process. So we got the input of the membership. Again, the MACSA membership represents all 87 counties, directors of human services and social service programs. That I will leave at that, and I will stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thiel. Can you explain to the committee when that information is recorded by the applicant of their self-employment income or their business income, and things have to be added back, like depreciation, to their income, how does that occur, and how is that reviewed?
Madam Chair, what we're looking at here is their, you know, how they're using that business income that becomes available to them to pay personal expenses. So you mentioned depreciation, some of those other things. So that's more in the Department of Revenue tax accounting part. We're just saying if it may be helpful, I do have an example of a case here where somebody was receiving public assistance benefits, still does receive public assistance benefits because we were unable to fully prosecute them because of this deficit in the statute with not defining income. If that's helpful, I can read through that. I can make it sort of brief, I guess, but it might help kind of give you a real life example. If you think that's helpful, I'd be willing to do that.
Could you do that briefly? Thank you.
Sure. So here's an example of a case I applied for public assistance, and after several administrative hearings, and it was also dismissed by our district court. I just stated, but the family remains open. So these are numbers are old, but this is the case. A married couple with several children owned and operated several businesses. When they applied for public assistance, they claimed $1,000 a month in income and $810 in monthly expenses. When their lifestyle didn't match this accounting, our investigation discovered they purchased a home, a $350,000 home with $20,000 down, payment of $2,500, taxes of $6,000 per year, all of it current. They own three vehicles ranging from $33,000 to $54,000, all with personalized plates, all monthly payments paid each month. Revolving credit of around $1,100 and installment payments of around $5,000, about $6,000 in expenses there, all current. On their credit application, it showed the husband's income as $105,000 a year and the wife's income is $45,000 a year. All of their personal expenses were being paid through the business accounts and only minimum income. Again, the definition is fuzzy on what is being paid to the client from the business. Therefore, we were only utilized the income from the self-reported, no verification required, was actually paid to them, which he claimed was $1,000, when the fact they received a significant payments from the business. That's the scenario. That's one scenario. There's other scenarios for that. So we're not talking about folks with low income. If you have yourself employed and you still qualify, that's fine. But this is somebody that's clearly has the resources to fully support themselves, yet they were taking advantage of all the systems because of they were able to activate that loophole. So I'm not sure if that answers your question. And what also too, I want to state what we're looking for, why we're saying we're not turning financial workers into tax accounts, really is looking at bank statements. You're moving money from here. You're moving $2,500 from this account to pay your house payment. That should be counted. That's part of the income, kind of to make it brief. But we had in the work group, I think Deborah Slick is still on the line, may be able to help with the work group, but we had a lot of discussions about, you know, how this would look and when we make referrals to Department of Revenue when we think there may be fraud going on there. But this is really, in our county, we have a really robust a fraud prevention program, and we do really well with finding folks that are not doing the right thing. So that's why we support this bill and why MAXA supports the bill.
Thank you for that example. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a few questions in regard to when somebody is self-employed. Is the bank account for the recipient treated as an asset or as an income?
Mr.
I've got several
Theo?
Questions as a follow-up.
Mr. Theo?
Madam Chair, Representative. So, if they're using the business account to pay their personal expenses, then that money that they transfer from one to the other, or maybe not even transfer, but just use that account, those amounts would be counted as both income. This bill will help us get a definition of what income is, and it would also be counted as an asset. So it would do both.
Madam Chair. So I just wanted to ask about the simplified reporting as we look into the income for the last 12 months based on the tax returns, which reflects on if somebody owned, whether it's self-employed, different entities fall under that. Are we looking into the simplified reporting process by using the tax documents to ensure that we do have integrity in the system? Is that how we should be operating, or is this something that we have to operate on a daily collection of data, revenue versus expenses, is the way that we used to do with receipts and so many other things for self-employed individuals?
Mr. Thiel?
Madam Chair, Representative, we use a multiple of information, as you stated, so a tax return could be one source. We would also be looking for, this bill would allow us to get, what we're looking for is bank statements so we can see what actually is being paid, because a tax return could look different than what income is actually coming through. So we would be this would give us the ability to look at the bank statement. So how is it getting paid? Who's paying those bills? Where's that money coming from? And then count that as income.
Thank you, Mr. Madam Chair. Go ahead, Representative Noor.
I think there's a difference between income eligibility and verifying assets for an individual to make sure that we do have an integrity in the system versus somebody who wants to commit fraud in the process. In fact, for a person to be collecting their daily expenses from their business, that is also a bigger challenge that we have to be looking into. But I think in this process, when we're looking at the assets and the income for self-employed, we do have a simplified process of looking into their tax returns, which will include everything. Otherwise, I think this is just beyond the program itself. So even to that extent, I just have a quick question for Ms. Schlick. Other states have already taken off the table the calculations of assets. I know our asset limit is 10,000. What is the future of looking into calculating those resources? We don't want to turn the workers into tax auditors or anything. What is the plan forward to ensure that we take into account the total income, whether you do have an S corporation or a different entity where it can be commingled with other individuals who are part of that business?
Ms. Schlick?
Representative Schultz and Representative Noor. And I can introduce myself last time. I'm Deborah Schlick. I work for the Minnesota Department of Human Services. So to build on Mr. Thiel's answer, there are a couple of pieces here. There are one of two ways that we will accept documentation and figure out what the income is. We will look at one option is to look at the tax form for the most recent year. We follow SNAP process. So to a question Representative Schultz asked a couple of minutes ago, we don't allow depreciation to reduce that income. So if there's depreciation on the tax form, that has to be put back into the reported income. The other option, we have aligned our state's cash assistance policies with the SNAP program, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And the second option SNAP allows is that we need to see all your income, and we will assume 50% of that income is deducted as expenses. So that was done to address the problem that Representative Noor raised that was a major concern for counties, and this has been in place since for a number of years now. But county workers were trying to look at all the receipts, look at all the invoices, and do a monthly auditing and bookkeeping for self-employed individuals, and that was not workable. And then the other point that Mr. Thiel made is that because anytime any account that someone holds or has access to is used to pay any personal expenses, that account then has to be reported, it has to be verified, it will count in the asset limit. And that was a key piece to address the concern Anoka saw of needing to have a legal handle to require reporting and verification of those accounts to then allow investigations to proceed.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick. Representative Noor?
My final question, Madam Chair, is as a state, we have not invested in micro enterprises, which is to allow small business individuals to build wealth and to become more self-sufficient. Is there a plan that we can look into providing that technical assistance and the support under the TANF program for the state so that we can avoid these challenges? And we can use qualified individuals under this program who are going to be verifying and helping the state to ensure that individuals who are self-employed receive the best assistance and so they can become self-sufficient.
Ms. Schlick or Mr. Thiel?
Representative Schultz and Representative Noor, there are no proposals this session to do microenterprise business support.
Thank you. Representative Noor?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's something I think I will be looking into to ensure that people can build wealth and become self-sufficient, which is the goal for the programs that we're dealing with. So we don't have the guessing process that we're doing when someone is self-employed and remove the complexities that the counties are dealing with so that we can have an assured data and to be able to process this case as accurately. So thank you so much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Sandel.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Thiel. It seems like both bills we've discussed this morning have the intent of providing the county and the state accurate, complete, and reliable information. I wonder if the counties have, as we've kind of hinted at, an ombudsman for an individual to be able to contact if they have some problems or questions about filling out the their applications for MFED correctly, or making sure that they understand the requirements of applications when they're talking about a self-employed business as well. Seems to me we're talking about a lot of money, and we want to be fair to everyone, and we want to accomplish the goals and the missions of these programs. It seemed to me that the kind of help that Representative Neuer was talking about, or the kind of help that Representative Albright was talking about, might be cleared up a bit if we had, you know, direct support for individuals who want to make sure that their information is complete and correct the first time around.
Mr. Thiel?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think that Deborah Schlick could weigh in if I'm off on this, but that I think that role, there isn't a separate entity that I'm aware of. If folks are coming in for, you know, filling out a form, I think that burden lands on us as a county to ask the questions and to make sure the forms are complete and the verifications are there so we meet all of our obligations. If somebody has a question, I think they can call DHS. I'm not sure that there's somebody there that can help them. I understand what you're saying. Like, is there somebody, a neutral party that can be there to help them so they understand it? But I think right now that burden rests with us, and we do the best we can in that regard.
Ms. Schlick, do you want to offer any additional? No? Okay, you were nodding your head. Representative Sandel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is an issue that I think is important, and it would it certainly help the states and county, and the clients, as Representative Fisher said, are often under stress and want to do well, and we want to help them, and we certainly want to avoid misrepresentation, which it might be illegal. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Representative Sandel. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not quite sure who to pose this question to, so I'll leave it up to you to direct it to the pertinent party. But the bill clarifies that CCAP families don't have to take part in self-employment budgeting. And is that something that they have participated in the past? And if so, why are we now saying they don't need to take part in it?
Ms. Schlick, I believe that this includes CCAP, and it's differentiating the bill because it's in a different statute area, but it's trying to treat all programs in a similar manner. But Ms. Schlick, you can elaborate.
Representative Schultz and Representative Albright, I can give you a partial answer. You're right, Representative Schultz. This is already addressed in CCAP programs. I am not an expert in CCAP policy, so I think we should get back to you if you'd like some specific information about how CCAP treats self-employment income.
Representative Albright?
That's fine. I would appreciate that clarification. Just one more point, and this is if Representative Cagle could elaborate. And the bill also talks about adding that, you know, the value of business accounts, and Representative Knorr was very articulate on this, but I just want to have a point of clarification. As the value of business accounts used to pay expenses not related to the business. So if they're business accounts but not related to the business, how are they really treated as business accounts? I'm wondering if someone could help me understand a business account that's not related to the business.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that's the whole point of the bill, is that we're trying to really make sure that folks who need assistance are getting assistance. And so, you know, the mingling of accounts is something that needs to be taken into account so that when, you know, when families are in need, that we can get them the assistance they need. And so I think that's really kind of, you know, the point of the bill is that if somebody's using a business account to pay, you know, household expenses, then that be taken into account. And I don't know if Mr. Thiel or Ms. Schlick have anything to add.
Ms. Schlick or Mr. Thiel?
Madam Chair, I think that explanation is, makes the point. That's what we're what the purpose of the bill is. If somebody has a they're using that business account to pay personal expenses, then it shouldn't be counted as in the business. It's counted as their part of their income for determining eligibility. So I think that's a critical point of the bill. So that would be my comment.
Thank you. My understanding, Representative Albright, is that these are business accounts, but they're using them for non-business expenses, and that's where the evaluation is. Representative Albright?
Thank you. We could go down that rabbit trail, but I'll wait for another opportunity on that one. Mr. Thiel, you mentioned about checking, the agency is going to check business accounts, checking savings, that type of thing, in, to verify eligibility. Does that occur only once with the preceding tax returns, or what's the frequency with which you're verifying changes to those business tax records?
Mr. Thiel?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, those would be reviewed and checked when an issue arises to us. We'd be asking for those account, you know, the verification upon applying, or the renewal, or when we discover that, you know, the story doesn't match, then we would be able to get those accounts and then do a further investigation on them. So we would do them as needed and as part of the verification when they're using those business accounts to pay personal expenses.
Representative Albright?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And that just raises a question, Mr. Thiel. So in the initial application, the applicant would disclose or declare, let's say, their ownership in a S corp or an LLC, or maybe even an interest in a corporation. So to Representative Knorr's point in terms of assets versus income, are you differentiating between the types of ownership as well as their income coming from it? And if it's an income that is identified available to them, but they're putting it back into the business, how do you, where's the differentiation? And it's not a gotcha question. I'm just trying to understand really what precipitates an issue. I think to exactly what Representative Knorr talks about in terms of, are we penalizing assets held by a business as opposed to the income that is being generated but plowed back into the business as an asset for that business.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Mr. Thiel?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, what precipitates it is when somebody's, what they've put on their application for benefits does not match their lifestyle would be sort of the trigger for us. And it's the income, what we want to define as income is money they're using in their business. So we're not getting in, I don't think any of this anticipates that we're trying to figure out what kind of business they are, how it's registered. It's about the money. So if they have $2,500 in their business account, they write the check for their house payment of $2,500, that's income to them that would be counted for eligibility on a sort of a real simple scale. So whether or not it's an asset or income, we're trying to figure out, is it income? Are they using that income? Because they're not claiming it as income as you and I would necessarily, saying I have, you know, $2,500 worth of income. They're saying I have no income, but my house payment is, or I have, or, you know, my personal expenses of $2,500 are taken care of, but I don't have any income. Well, that's the problem that we have identified. That's the problem that we're working to solve with the bill. I think what got us the most furthest forward is that stakeholder group that I talked about earlier, that we spend a lot of time, that group, working with multiple departments, Department of Revenue, having the same discussion that we're having today, which is a great discussion. But where we're getting at is people are using, you know, they're not telling us that I have income. They say I have no income, but yet I'm living a lifestyle that would show otherwise. So it's just those parts. When you're just, if you're using your business account, however it's registered, to pay personal expenses, we want that on the other side of the ledger to say this is income, and that's how we're going to determine whether or not you're eligible. Because we do want this, to be clear, we want folks that are eligible for programs to be eligible, to get them on their way to, you know, be here. These programs are supposed to be short term, get people over the hump and get them going when they're having problems. So we want the people that are eligible absolutely to have them and have it verified. People who are not eligible and are taking advantage of our systems, or some of these are very expensive, these are the folks that we want not receiving benefit, because that's, you know, taking benefits away from people that really need them. And that's thank the purpose of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Thiel. And after reading through that work group report or letter, my understanding is they can accumulate capital in their business if they're not using it for non-business purposes. So they're able to, you know, keep a reserve of capital to build their business or invest in their business. But what this program will look at is what they use the business income for, the purposes. And that's what's, they're trying to differentiate that, if it's real income or if it's business income or capital. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I totally agree with this. One of the questions that I have for Mr. Thiel is, how far out are the relationships extended? Obviously for family businesses and or families where you might have, you know, four or five individuals working in various functions or in related organizations. How do you capture or identify those income sources, particularly if you might also just have the head of household tax filing or married filing separately, but yet there is additional income coming into the business based upon their employ with that same organization and or others that have familial relationships attached to them? That will conclude my questions, Madam Chair.
Mr. Thiel?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I think the examples that we have are a little one step, I think, a little bit closer, but my answer would be, it's still around how is that business, the money in that business account being, is it being used to pay personal expenses, which allows the applicant to underreport their income? Then that's where it's going to tie together. So it's really at that premise of how you're using that. So I think if we had a case that was like you described, we'd have to unpack that through our investigation process. But we're really looking, you know, really looking at it to meet that you're using a business account to pay a personal expense. It's really kind of that. It can be a little more complicated with that, but that's really at the heart of what this bill is doing, and the work that was a conclusion of the work group as well.
Thank you, Mr. Thiel. I'm not seeing any more questions. Representative Cagle, do you have any closing remarks?
I just want to thank you, Madam Chair, and the members of the committee for hearing this bill. I think this is important to make sure that we're able to get people the assistance they need when they need it, and that we are trying to weed out, you know, waste, fraud, and abuse. So thank you again.
Okay, I'll renew my motion. So House File 822 will be laid over for possible inclusion. Okay, the last bill that we'll be hearing today is House File 1339. Representative Pinto, would you like to make a motion to re-refer House File 1339 to the Committee on Health Services, Finance, and Policy?
So moved, Madam Chair.
So Representative Pinto moves that House File 1339 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. So Representative Pinto, to your bill, and it looks like I don't have any amendments, and I have one testifier listed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and that is correct. This bill, House File 1339, excludes income and asset payments for the purpose of determining eligibility for certain programs, and it really is in connection with an experiment that's being run, a pilot program for guaranteed income in the city of St. Paul. I should note that there was a similar change that was made in previous years for the Baby's First Years program. It's a very small program, but we want to make sure that it's kind of allowed to run its course so we can get the data that we need. What I'd like to do is to turn to the testifier from the city of St. Paul, Mr. Carker Ramos, and then go from there, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. So we have Mr. Carker Ramos from the city of St. Paul. Please introduce yourself to the committee and your affiliation, and then begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Munir Carter Ramos. I'm with the City of St. Paul. I'm here before you today with a bill to provide an income and asset exclusion to preserve families' public benefits as a result of them participating in an 18-month demonstration project and research study that looks at the impacts of income supports on poverty and economic well-being. The research study is being conducted by the University of Pennsylvania and over 30 cities across the country to look at the impact of guaranteed income on different indicators of poverty reduction. And in our instance, it'll be on also on early childhood indicators. In the city of St. Paul, this will include 150 families with young children receiving $500 a month in income supports for 18 months. The main point of this bill is to prevent families from having their public benefits adversely impacted by their participation in the St. Paul demonstration project and the national study. As Representative Pinto mentioned, there is precedent for the state legislature in supporting income and asset exclusions. Back in 2016, the state legislature provided Columbia University's Baby's First Year study with an income and asset exclusion for the Child Care Assistance Program, Minnesota Family Investment Program, Medical Assistance, and Minnesota Care. The city is asking the state legislature for the same exclusions, and like Baby's First Year study bill that was in front of the legislature in 2016, this is a policy bill with no fiscal, no core budget impact. With that said, I'll conclude with my testimony and stand for questions alongside my colleague here, Casey Mujic, who's also with me.
Thank you for that testimony. So this is an interesting study happening in various cities. I'm intrigued by the research to see and the impact that cash assistance, direct cash assistance can help with families and the improvement in their lives. Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, is it necessary to get federal waivers for this, for us to exclude the income for our public programs? Do you know offhand?
Mr. Carter Ramos or Representative Pinto?
Madam Chair, Representative, so with some of the programs, there will be a need to get a federal waiver, and I would defer to DHS staff on that.
Yes, Ms. Schlick or others from DHS, if you could help answer that question. Do we need federal waivers to exclude income?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jennifer Sommerfeld from the Department of Human Services. I don't know an answer to that, to be honest with you right now. I'll have to check in and get back to you on that.
Thank you, Ms. Sommer. Representative Liebling?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And just, you know, I think sometimes in the past when we've needed federal waivers, there's been a cost associated with that. So I think, Madam Chair, I missed, is this going to be laid over? Is it going to health?
This is going to your committee, Chair Lee.
Yeah, I thought that might be. It's kind of too bad we have to do that sort of circuitous path for this, but I just hope that it doesn't have a fiscal impact. I think it's a really interesting program, and you know, I'd like to be able to see this continue. If I could just ask another question, I'm sorry if I missed this, but there's a document that's on the city's webpage about this, there's a reference to an authorization for this before, and I think you mentioned it. Could you just explain clearly, was this authorized previously and needs to be reauthorized, or exactly in terms of what the state needs to do to allow the, you know, not to impact the other programs that folks are on.
Mr. Karsher Ramos.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think the reference is to the precedents for an income and asset exclusion for the baby's first year study. So in 2016, the legislature granted an income and asset exclusion for public benefits eligibility for that study. And that was for what that program was 250 Minnesota families who could receive up to $333 a month. There's a couple different tiers in that study, and that was going to be lasting for 40 months. And that was to ensure the payments did not count toward eligibility for MFIP, SNAP, CCAP, medical assistance, Minnesota Care. So that particular piece of legislation was just for that study. So this particular bill is also looking for this demonstration project and study to also be have the income and asset exclusions as well.
Okay, well, thank you, Madam Chair. So thank you for that. So there's some precedent. It's not the same thing, but it's kind of a precedent for it. Okay, that's helpful. Thank you very much.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Pinto, for bringing this bill. I have two questions. First, I'm confused why there isn't a fiscal impact, because unless we have this bill, it appears there would be less people eligible for these other programs. So by bringing this bill and continuing their eligibility, like in absence of this bill, wouldn't there be fewer people eligible? So that would be a savings. So why isn't there a fiscal impact?
Mr. Berg.
Madam Chair, Representative Robbins, I'm not sure that I can answer your question. What I can tell you is this bill will have a fiscal impact. I don't think it will have the impact that you are looking at, which is people either qualifying or not qualifying for benefits. I believe that's kind of the idea here, is to take that out of the equation. There will, however, be, to my knowledge, systems costs at DHS to do some reprogramming to allow this to happen. The fiscal note has not been requested yet, because I understand that DHS and I believe the author are having some discussion about exactly what the language should look like.
Thank you, Mr. Burr. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have one follow-up. So my other question is more about the study itself. So this seems to imply that we're just studying the impact of not counting universal basic income on eligibility for other programs and how it would then affect their ability to move out of poverty. So that would imply, I think, that future universal basic income programs would also have these exemptions. So are we sort of, it would also be interesting to study the reverse, where is if this counts for their eligibility and they are taking off some programs, what impact does universal basic income have? So I feel like we're sort of, we should study both perhaps, but I feel like we're studying only in one direction that presumes universal basic income would in the future also receive similar exemptions. Could you speak to that, Representative Pinto? Thank you.
Well, Representative Pinto, that's not really the intent of hearing this bill, to talk about the study. It's an interesting study. Representative Pinto, if you can make a brief comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Robbins. And I guess I'll just note that if what's being studied is to say, if you have somebody with a brand new baby who's living in poverty, you know, what is the impact of lifting their income by a certain amount? You kind of have to. It can't be that they lose some other benefit. Well, then you haven't actually had that effect. I guess that'd be my thought. Mr. Karcher Ramos may have a thought as well. I know, Madam Chair, it's a little bit outside. So however you want to handle that, but.
Well, I think when you're looking at cash assistance, you can add on the public assistance programs to their universal benefit to see if in total they help move people out of poverty. Then it helps you level set how much that universal basic income could or should be. But Mr. Karsher Ramos.
Madam Chair, Representative, Yeah, so the study is looking at, you know, income volatility, sort of economic choices, you know, what do folks decide to sort of use the dollars for around debt, savings, wealth, impacts on physical, mental health, parenting, engagement with self, college savings, those sorts of things. So, you know, there is, you know, the exclusion is to look at sort of the net additional sort of impact, you know, on families. So that is sort of the intended impact of the study.
Okay, Representative Robbins. Okay, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious, Mr. Karcher-Ramos, with your just recent explanation in terms of, I mean, it should be obvious that if you raise someone's income, whether it be with or without consideration of taxes, that your economic profile is going to be improved. So to the point of the study, you mentioned and other ancillary points, what's the point of, you know, excluding the income if we already know that if a family or an individual has more income, discretionary or otherwise, to have available to them, their lot in life is going to be improved. So I'm at a loss. I was at a loss when St. Paul instituted this, but I'm even more at a loss for why we would need to exclude it just for the sake of not having it impact other benefits that they receive. Could you help me understand why?
Representative Albright, I believe we don't want to penalize these families for enrolling in this research study, but Mr. Karcher-Ramos?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, the purpose is, you know, not to have any adverse impacts, you know, on the participants, you know, public benefits, right? So, you know, it is a demonstration project. It is 18 months, you know, the study will yield sort of what does it look like during that 18 months, but, you know, different families will take different trajectories and that sort of thing in the program, and, you know, it's uncertain where folks will be at the end of that 18 months, so we're really looking to mitigate any loss of their public benefit.
Thank you. And it's true that they'll have more income, but the study is looking at, is it going to improve their health outcomes? Is it going to help them secure a job and work and stabilize their life or their housing situation? So it's more than just about giving them income. It's giving them opportunities and see how they translate those opportunities. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Pinto, for bringing this bill here today. I was wondering how you would think about, you know, issues of kind of equity, you know, across the state. You know, I represent Otter Tail County, and if I was talking to a family in Fergus Falls that maybe received $500 in income from another source that would have to be reportable to DHS, you know, just, you know, how we would think about kind of the fairness of that relative to having this exemption for families in St. Paul that are participating in this novel program.
Representative Pinto.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Rasmussen. I think because of the fact that this is a research study, it's time limited. It's a small number of families. I guess I would think that most folks across the state would understand. You'd say, look, we're trying to study how this works for a limited amount of time, and you know, families would not be able to, would not choose and probably wouldn't be in position to choose to participate in the research study if we didn't take the steps. I really view it as a technical step in that way. And I guess I would think that families in your community would be supportive of that, while recognizing, of course, the need to lift up all families across the state. There's simply plenty, there's certainly plenty that we should be doing on that, and this committee's working on as well.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you. Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Pinto. Appreciate that.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you for that. So I just wanted to be clear, you know, right now, for example, if we don't take this action, we don't necessarily need a study to happen with what happens when we don't have it, because that's actually what's happening today. And so what the whole point of the study in and of itself is to see if we give a modest,
I think we lost Representative Bonner. You're breaking up, Representative Bonner. You may need to turn off your video so we can just hear your audio.
Amount to a family. Choose other benefits. And so, I think, quite frankly, the scope of this is relatively short. But having said that, it does have the ability to give us some insights into thoughts that we might pursue in the future, whether something works or doesn't work, and what those impacts might be. And so I guess I would just support this, and I appreciate Representative Pinto bringing this forward, because certainly we don't want families losing benefits in trying to work their way out of poverty.
Thank you, Representative Bonner, for those comments. Any closing remarks, Representative Pinto?
I'll thank you, Madam Chair and members, and really just emphasize that, that regardless of your thoughts about the about what the possible study findings may be, or even the study itself, just the idea that as long as this is going on, we really do need to make this technical fix as we have for past research studies in order to make sure that it can actually work. And so I really urge members' support in moving this to the Health Committee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pinto, and thank you, members, for all your questions and being curious about the study. So Representative Pinto renews his motion to re-refer House File 1339 to Health, Finance, and Policy, and we're going to have to roll call this. So Ms. Hansen, Chair votes aye.
Schultz votes aye. Vice Chair Bonner?
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Lead Albright?
No.
Albright, no. Representative Bolden?
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Burkle?
No.
Burkle, no. Representative Fisher? Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hansen?
Hansen, aye.
Representative Keel?
Keel, no.
Keel, no. Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Moeller?
Aye.
Moeller, aye. Representative Moore?
Yes.
Moore, yes. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, no.
Novotny, no. Representative Pearson?
Pearson, no.
Pearson, no. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, no.
Rasmussen, no. Representative Robbins?
No.
Robbins, no. Representative Sandel?
Aye.
Sandel, aye. Representative Schumacher, excused. So Chair Schultz.
Fisher votes aye.
Hi, okay. Thank you, Representative Fisher. Fisher votes aye. Chair Schultz, that's 11 ayes, 7 nays, and 1 excused.
The motion passes. House File 1339 will be re-referred to Health, Finance, and Policy. So thank you, members. That's all we have on the agenda today. So I look forward to seeing everyone tomorrow, and we'll be hearing 3 additional bills. And with that, we are adjourned.